This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend. I've
walked your snow-capped mountains. Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is January 7th, 2021, and this is episode 221.
I'm Stark Lundebohm.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we kick it off by recapping our predictions for 2020, and then we look ahead at 2021 and make ones that are probably going to be even more wrong, at least for me. Then Scott has a special interview with repeat guest Micah about the recent BC court ruling where they sided with a polyamorous father over the COVID-19 orders coming out of the public health office. And we close off with quick takes, as always. First, of course, thank you to the growing number of patrons, especially all of those new ones who signed up in the last couple of weeks. We're up to 103 in total. That is Anne, Mercedes, Jordan, Jeff, Courtney, Vanessa, Brett, and Caitlin, who all signed up recently. I think a number of you signed up during our live show, which was awesome. Great to have you. Hope you're enjoying the Slack. Conversations in there have been great. And well, we've just all been terrified by the news out of the US, so that channel has been pretty hot. But you can join them and support the podcast at patreon.com/politicoast. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. We want to let you know about a new podcast, The Peak Weekly. Each week, The Peak's Brett Chang and Alex Blumenstein talk to the most interesting people in Canadian business. Featuring interviews with Canadian leaders in tech, culture, and finance, The Peak Weekly is the fastest way to get smarter about business. You can subscribe to it wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search for The Peak Weekly. And before we get into today's show, Scott, how are you doing? How are you feeling about the state of American democracy as we start 2021?
I'm trying to decide exactly which bit of profanity most adequately sums up my feelings here, because it is just not very good. So we're recording this the day after there was a insurrection attempt at the Capitol building in the US. And I don't know, is it possible to both be like stunned in shock and yet find something very predictable?
It existed
in this weird juxtaposition for me.
It was what we all knew was going to happen or expected, but it just, I think we were slowly getting to the, we're almost there. It's 2 weeks to go until Biden inauguration day. And then we can just put this behind us. And nope, they stormed in full QAnon, Christian nationalist, every white supremacist, all blended into a toxic mix. Apparently got by security pretty easily. Somehow the entire anti-terrorism apparatus of the US missed that thousands of people were planning to do something. Like, it was going to be a rally, but it seemed like some people had this doesn't just happen.
Yeah, so there is no doubt going to be a major inquiry following this. There was some reporting today from the AP that said that the Capitol Police, the agency that does security on the Hill itself, not the DC police, had been offered assistance by both the Department of Defense and the FBI, and they had turned it down. Which is just a shocking level of incompetence. The whole thing has a real Bin Laden determined to strike US feeling to it. The famous memo from August 2001, that it was both predictable and everyone, and the warning signs were ignored when it was identified.
The obvious other comparison people make are to the beer hall putsch of Hitler, not to Godwin's law ourselves, but that's where things always had.
It's not entirely an inappropriate comparison either. But the other thing that gets me is this already happened this year in Michigan, and there was very little response to it and not much done. And I just do not understand why the Michigan National Guard and State Police didn't clear everyone out of that building the moment it happened and arrest anyone in there. And I can't help but wonder if that had gone differently, whether or not this would have happened.
Yeah, we did see Canadian politicians react to this to bring this back to our own main focus. There's enough people talking about American politics. Trudeau initially expressed his disappointment and sadness on the issue, but then later tweeted out that Canadians are deeply disturbed and saddened by the attack on democracy, our closest ally and neighbor. Violence will never succeed in overruling the will of the people. Democracy must be upheld, and it will be. Jagmeet Singh tweeted something similarly strong, and then also reiterated the NDP's petition to designate the Proud Boys as a terrorist organization. The Proud Boys being, I believe, fairly involved in this. They've been involved in a number of violent incidents in the States. Aaron O'Toole also had a similar strong statement. It was good to see a united front on all of those. I think some of the first comments from Trudeau weren't as strong, but they're better now.
Yeah, and the Conservative Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs, Michael Chong, put out a similarly strong statement today as well. So I think Canadian politicians are all equally shocked and appalled by this, which is a reassuring bit of national unity. But yeah, it's very concerning for Canada. Like you said, everyone from the U.S. is talking about it. I don't think we're going to have any particular insight into what's happening in the U.S. that you couldn't find from a U.S. podcast. But in terms of Canada, this is the sort of thing that ought to prompt a pretty big reassessment of our relationship with the U.S. Now, that just due to geography, size, a whole bunch of factors, it's never not going to be our most important relationship with another country. But having a politically unstable neighbor to our south that we are highly integrated with, both economically and in terms of our national security structures, is something that ought to prompt a lot of concern and reassessment on whether or not that's going to be a reliable relationship going forward. Because with any luck, in 2 weeks' time, roughly, Joe Biden is going to be president. There's going to be a trifecta in Washington of Democratic control, but who knows what's going to happen in 2 years after the midterms, 4 years after the next election, and hopefully things will equilibrate back to a much better normal. But we could very easily find ourselves in this position in a few years' time, and I think it would be incumbent upon our national leaders to treat this not as the end, but as a reprieve, and plan accordingly. And hopefully we won't have to rely on those plans, but I think that would be the prudent thing to do.
Absolutely. And I'm going to be putting a lot more thought and hopefully some reading into approaches to foreign policy that are beyond relying on the U.S. and what Canada could do. I think the other angle to be thinking a lot about is that Canada isn't some exceptionally special country. Nowhere is. This kind of revolt can happen anywhere. We see it happen all around the world all the time. It takes different forms. We need to think about divides and the tensions present within our own society. We've seen in the last couple of years violent attacks on mosques. There was the shooter who went to Parliament Hill. We haven't seen, I don't think we're likely to see anything as big as what just happened in the US anytime soon in Canada. But I think people would have said the same about that in the US 2, 3, 5 years ago. And here we are.
Yeah. And just to add on to that, I think it would be incumbent upon everyone in Canada to be really cautious about importing American political disputes. We have a really bad tendency, and every party in this country is guilty of that, of trying to take issues that are very divisive in the US and try and apply them to Canada for quick political gains when we don't necessarily have the same fault lines, the same politics, and we are, in fact, a separate country with our separate political divisions and issues, and trying to enact or harness the American culture wars for short-term political benefit is something that not only politicians shouldn't do, but I think we as commentators shouldn't do it, and nor should Canadians overall be very tolerant of that going forward.
And with that, I think we can turn it over to our recap of how our thoughts went for 2020 and what we think might come about in 2021. Hopefully not insurrection, but we've been wrong in the past. So we dug through the archives. You actually did this for us, thankfully, and found our previous year in review prediction episode was episode 169 at the start of 2020. We've done this a couple of years.
Actually, it was the last episode of 2019. Normally, we try and do these for our kind of year-end episodes. It makes a good end to the year. Our year-end live show focused on other things this year. We didn't really have time to get into predictions, so we thought we'd bring them in for the first episode of the year. And I guess first question is, did we get the big story of 2020 right?
Oh, did we predict a global pandemic shutting down or forcing countries to shut down everything? I think I missed that.
Yeah, me too. We both missed that one. Nevertheless, we did talk about a few things that happened and a couple that didn't. So let's dive into it. I guess the other big political or big story of 2020, and it was related to what we were just talking about, is what happens in the US with their presidential election. We both had some predictions on that. So you predicted something related to whether or not Biden was going to be able to succeed if he won the nomination.
Yeah, I think I forget the exact words I said, but I basically said if Biden was nominated, Trump would win, and that did not happen. There's been a number of retrospectives on the election and whether COVID cost it for Trump. Like, it was close enough that a lot of people were very terrified and Trump almost pulled it off. So maybe without COVID, I would have been right. I didn't want to be right. Of course, I am glad for the result.
Yeah, I went back and checked the recording on this one. I believe your thinking at the time was related to whether or not the kind of repeat of the Hillary campaign would be successful. And I think that Biden ran a separate campaign that targeted different parts of America, spoke a bit differently. So in that respect, I think he learn from the past mistakes and handle things better.
There was
better.
Also a very strong get the fucker out movement, really pushed by the Black community in the South, among others. The push of Black Lives Matter over the last year and the defund the police that really came together in the States. Really.
Although that second part, I'm pretty skeptical of how much that really move things in the Democrats' favor. I didn't actually put down a prediction on whether or not Biden would be successful. I didn't actually call out a winner of the primary at all, or put forward a prediction on whether or not they were going to be successful, depending on how that turned out. But thinking back to where I was thinking at the time, I do think that Trump lucked into the 2016 win, and that in addition to the get the guy out mentality, there was enough that could be, if you reran that election with just a couple tweaks differently, it would have led to a Democratic victory. So I think I was a little more optimistic on that. The one area I was, and as a result, I did predict that the Democrats would win the White House overall. I also had thoughts on the Senate, which until a couple days ago, I was expecting to be proven wrong on that, where I said that the Democrats would narrowly win the Senate. So you were
technically wrong on election night and in 2020, because they only narrowly won
yes.
it 2 days ago.
I'm going to count that anyway, as because it is, in fact, the result of the this is still a continuation of the 2020 election. Those seats were not filled on election night in Georgia. And as a result, this election was triggered. So, yeah, I am going to count it as a win.
We both called that Trump would not be removed from office in 2020, and that's been upheld. That was true. He might be removed by the time you're listening to this, or even in the next 2 weeks, if not before the 20th.
Yeah, so when we recorded this last prediction episode, impeachment was in the air. There was talk about that, and somehow we are right back into that situation a year later. The good news is that regardless of whether or not impeachment happens, he will, in fact, be out of office this year. But let's move on to Canadian politics and what we thought was going to happen here. We had slightly different views on whether or not there were going to be any election calls. You said there were going to be no elections at any level, where I figured we'd probably have no federal election, but I wasn't willing to put money down on the province and feel somewhat vindicated in that.
According to Horgan's official story, it wasn't until the summer that he decided to go for a early snap election. And I think without COVID, it would be harder to... I don't know if he would have called it without COVID. It definitely gave him the advantage, but
I think he likely would have anyway, because he did call it the week the Green Party elected their leader, which was a very strategic move on his part that would have happened regardless of whether or not COVID happened. And he entered the year with good approval ratings, probably would have stayed relatively popular had with or without COVID. So I actually think it was probably pretty likely that would have happened in the alternate history 2020, where there is no
pandemic. There were also a couple of leadership races that we tried to make predictions on. The conservative leadership race, I thought McKay would ultimately win it. I gave Ronna Ambrose a runner-up chance, though she did not even enter the race. And ultimately, Erin O'Toole did defeat McKay, who ran a terrible, forgettable campaign.
Missed on an open net, I believe, is the metaphor of choice for McKay's failure on that one. Yeah, I didn't actually predict anyone for the leadership race because, I don't know, leadership races are always hard to predict before the candidates are declared, and even then it's a little tough. Nevertheless, I did throw out a prediction for the BC Green leadership race, where I guessed that Vancouver councillor Pete Fry was going to run for leader. That turned out to be entirely incorrect. And then moving off of the who's going to run or what the elections are going to be, there was something that was occupying our attention last year, which was whether or not the federal government, which had hinted at building a tunnel to Labrador in one of their mandate letters, was actually going to go through with it. I figured probably not. And
there are still calls for the fixed link to Labrador. There was one from April saying it would be a way to provide the island of Newfoundland with food security during the pandemic. But
that's strikes me as a stretch, because admittedly, I am not entirely familiar with the precise nature of Labradorian agriculture, but I gather it is not exactly the breadbasket of Canada. And having,
I think the idea is you have a railway or highway from the tunnel exit in Labrador,
right,
to somewhere in Quebec where it's stuff actually is.
It is still a very long drive from where the tunnel in theory would emerge on the Labrador side of the channel to anywhere with a large food distribution and logistics hub.
Speaking of infrastructure, you also believed that the BC government would commit to a high-speed rail link to Portland. Can we give you part marks on that? Like, it's moving?
Yeah, I mean, when I said it, I was thinking, okay, we're actually going to make a significant funding commitment. It struck me in pre-pandemic times as like a good thing that would get stuck in a budget or be promised as a, oh, look at this thing that we want to do that's very on brand for us. Turns out that Dolly didn't make it into the budget with a big spending commitment. Other things got in the way. Nevertheless, in the background, the high-speed rail studying work was continuing on, and the government made continued soft commitments to it every time it came up. So yeah, I think part marks are due there. But there was another local BC issue that caught your attention, and this time it was daylight savings time.
Yeah. BC has been talking, and we passed a bill planning to change to that, and we said we'd wait for the US, and so far we have kept waiting for the US. So I said we wouldn't change in the last year, and that was the softball I think I took.
Yeah, that's probably a safe bet. And then just round out my predictions, I had a admittedly slightly vague prediction that Trudeau would have a rocky first year of minority government. Now, I thought this was mostly going to be due to the fact that the Liberals aren't very good at doing the hard work of actually getting stuff through the legislature, and I thought that was going to be even more challenging in a minority situation. Turns out the rockiness was from a slightly different cause, but yeah. I think that's at least part perks on that one.
There were definitely a lot of self-inflicted wounds on the federal Liberals' part with the yes. Wee scandal, prorogation, etc. They also didn't pass that many bills in the last year, like between the two sessions and the prorogation.
Almost nothing that wasn't directly pandemic related.
Even like the urgent medical assistance and dying one that they were supposed to pass before a court deadline. They just got the court deadline extended for, I think, the third time. So here we are.
So I'm not sure if it was that specific court case or if there were different extensions on different court decisions that they'd gotten. But yeah, not exactly a hugely productive year legislatively for the government. And then my final prediction was that there's going to be an incident that soured relations between China and the West.
Which is a fairly vague call.
Once again, it's a little vague. Admittedly, I had a kind of very like clear singular event in mind when I said that, but I think there's still partial credit due for several different events that, well, not a direct kind of conflict sort of event between China and the West, nevertheless contributed to worsening relations, and that is related to the Chinese government tearing up the agreement on the transfer of Hong Kong, the continued genocide in Xinjiang, and the refusal to share a lot of scientific information around COVID.
And we're still detaining Meng Wanzhou, and they're detaining the Michaels.
Yes, that too.
Yeah.
Although that was in process.
You had also said that Brexit would happen, which seemed pretty inevitable, but that would trigger a Scottish referendum.
So I still, the underlying logic behind the Scottish referendum, I think, still holds, and we'll get to that when we get to our 2021 predictions, but I think I was maybe a little hasty in figuring out how quickly it would follow a finalized Brexit deal. Any last thoughts on 2020 from you?
I had said something about the Greens struggling provincially and federally with new leaders with no seats and no name recognitions. Now the BC Greens got a leader who had a seat. And they actually did turn it around pretty well midway through the election. It was enough to hold everything in place, status quo, which was good for them. I think
And I'd also credit a very strong second place finish in West Vancouver, Sea to Sky. Mm-hmm. Speaks well to their ability to handle themselves electorally in BC.
And Annamie Paul, who I don't think either of us could have predicted would win the federal Green leadership race,
did well
in her by-election, but didn't break through. But that wasn't really expected.
Yeah. Neither of us called that particular leadership race. In fact, I said that without a declared elected person running in for the Greens, there is just no way to know who the relevant power players were who could assemble that sort of thing from our perspective, just out here in the coast, not being deeply involved in the Green Party. But yeah, I think the leadership win of Annamie Paul caught everyone by surprise a bit. But it's going to be interesting to see how the Greens shake out next year and possibly later on when they have to contest their first election post-Elizabeth May, which I think nicely brings us to 2021.
Yes, the year that will hopefully be better than 2020. But given the way the last week has gone, I'm just going to vaguely predict that I feel like it's all going to be worse. Like maybe personally, you and I will do a good year, but a lot of people might. But I'm pessimistic.
Slightly bright side there. So the first major crisis of 2020 was on January 3rd with the assassination of Soleimani, I want to say, the Iranian general that was killed by a U.S. strike that nearly led to war in the Middle East, and that crisis ultimately concluded in the shooting down of a civilian airliner over Iran. That was January 3rd when that kicked off. So we made it like three more days into 2021 before crisis. Trend line in the right direction, I'd say. However disappointing that is, or small comfort, I should say. Let's talk Canada. I don't think either of us are going to be predicting a particularly troublesome year for Canada, but what do you think is going to happen politically in 2020?
Well, the first thing to talk about is whether we'll have a federal election this year. It's pretty safe to say John Horgan won't call a snap election a year into a majority mandate, but federally, I do believe the tea leaves saying Trudeau will want to call a snap election at some point before the end of the year. I lean towards the spring, but I could also see it going into the fall. And I think it will go well for him. Like, even if he doesn't keep a plurality, he can keep it to a minority situation where he can maintain government, even if it's supported by NDP and Green votes.
So I also think there's likely to be a federal election, though I think the parameters might be a little different. So the speculation that's going on right now is all around whether or not there'll be one in the spring. I'm slightly skeptical of that because the federal government just announced a giant climate package that includes a very steep price on carbon that will no doubt be somewhat controversial and occupy a fair bit of political oxygen. And I think they're going to want to get that passed and put a few months' distance between themselves and that before any election is called. So I wouldn't rule out a spring election. I think one later in the year might be more likely. And contingent on there being an election, I think that Aaron O'Toole is more likely than not to win a plurality. I generally think he's been underestimated as a political force, both in the leadership race and somewhat post-leadership race. He came out of his victory trying to take the Conservative Party in a new direction that I think is more electorally advantageous than the vision that Andrew Scheer had. That has faltered somewhat, but I still think that when the rubber hits the road and they need to put together a full campaign on that, he'll be able to maybe not get a majority, but win a plurality. And the other prediction I'm going to make on this is that the People's Party is going to run less than 10 candidates and will basically be even more relevant than they were in the 2019 election. I think Maxime Bernier is vain enough that he'll run again and he'll probably get one or two hangers on, but it's not,
going to be even the
attempt that it was last time.
Continuing our look at the federal level, I'll say there's going to be some kind of major drug decriminalization pilot. Now, that might be the federal government agreeing to what Mayor Kennedy Stewart and council have asked for, which is to essentially exempt Vancouver from the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act to allow people to not be caught for possession. But it might also happen provincially through police act reforms and adopting some of the recommendations from the public health office or some combination of them. I think the calls are becoming stronger and it'll be hard for the government to not heed them, particularly as opioid deaths continue to be the under-discussed or overdose deaths continue to be the under-discussed ongoing crisis and tragedy.
I also have a public health prediction that this one I hope I'm wrong about, but I'm worried I won't be. And that's the vaccine distribution falls significantly behind schedule.
We have everyone vaccinated by the end of the year?
Everyone? No.
Everyone the provinces and country are aiming for September to get everyone. So we will know before the end of the year, if you're right.
Yeah, I'm more pessimistic on the first 6 to 9 months of the year being able to deliver that. And I think we'll probably be over 10%, 10 to 15% behind where we want to be for most of the year. We may actually catch up by the end of the year, although even then, I think that's a little iffy on whether or not we'll manage to get everyone vaccinated by the end of the year. There's enough challenges initially that I think we may not fully get our act together on it, but this is the one I most want to be wrong about.
You also think the federal government will, or you also think Trudeau will shuffle his cabinet this year?
Yeah, cabinet shuffles are always a fairly safe or high probability guess. I think decent chance we'll get a cabinet shuffle within the first 6 months of the year, if we aren't going to an election right away. And obviously post-election, there'll be a new cabinet. But assuming there's no early election, we'll likely have a federal cabinet shuffle. John Horton's been very stable with his cabinet, and I don't think that is going to change.
Yeah, I'll say there won't be a cabinet shuffle provincially. And by that, more than two MLAs changing roles, because there's always the situation where someone gets in a scandal or gets sick and needs to pass off their role, and that's not a real cabinet shuffle.
Yeah, I think that's a good rule for kind of both of us on where what we consider cabinet shuffle worthy of prediction.
One other thing while we're on the provincial scene is there is a BC Liberal leadership race. There are no declared candidates yet, as far as I know. But who's going to win?
We don't even know when it will be.
Presumably this year?
So the Constitution says it has to be within a year of the permanent leader position becoming vacant, but that leaves a pretty big range. It'll likely be towards October, which will be very close to the 1 year mark, but we'll see.
So I'll throw my chips on Todd Stone right now as the MLA, the candidate with, or the person most likely to bridge the different tents of the party, bring them all back together, and still bring a bit of enthusiasm back to the party.
Interesting. He ran last time, but notably didn't win or come in second. What makes you think he's going to be more successful this time?
I just can't think of anyone else who's got any name recognition. I don't think James Moore will enter, but I'm prepared to be proven wrong on that.
Yeah, he's the perennial person everybody talks about running, but he has shown zero interest in it post retirement from federal politics, and I really don't see that happening.
Where are you going?
So this might be a slightly wild card pick, but I wonder if Ellis Ross might run and actually do better than a lot of people expect and might win. So I'm going to put him down as the prediction for leader for the Liberal Party. And having a Indigenous leader for the Liberals would be would make BC politics quite interesting in a way that it hasn't been.
Yeah,
before.
Ross gets a lot of good praise for his capability in the House, and elsewise he'd be an interesting leader.
Yeah, and yeah, very pro-resource development too, which would, I think, create interesting tensions within BC politics. So, yeah, it's both a slightly outsiderish guess and one I want to see because, or one that has the potential to make BC politics quite interesting. After 2016, I no longer want to say something should happen because it will be interesting, but I think this could happen, so I'll throw down a prediction on
it. Let's rattle through the last couple quickly. Just sticking on provincial politics for my last one, I think this will be the year we make the change and stick with daylight savings time. I believe John Horgan was on record in the past couple months being like, you know what, even if the U.S. doesn't go ahead, we're just going to do it this year. And I'm taking it at his word at that. Maybe it's just a hope that he does it. But one more time change, people.
We can only hope. So yeah, I have two final predictions that I'll just rattle off quickly. One is that we will, this year, see a Scottish referendum. I think the general disaster that is, or difficulties around Brexit and all of that will eventually come to the head and will further fuel the kind of latent Scottish nationalism. And there will be another referendum there.
Will they vote to leave?
I think so. I think it definitely more likely this time. And yeah, I'd say I'm leaning towards a yes on that one. So yeah, call it a weak prediction that it would be a leave. They leave the UK, a pro join the EU. And my final prediction is that Trump or an immediate family member will be indicted.
We can be so hopeful.
There's only been, what, like 5 felonies committed within the last couple months by the
48 hours?
Yeah. I think we'll likely see at least a few people
pretty sure incitement to sedition is a crime.
Yeah. And there's a bunch of state-level crimes, including not voter intimidation, but attempts to illegally manipulate the Georgia election.
With that,
any final predictions?
No, I got nothing else. I'm just going to ask our listeners, if you have predictions for 2021, tweet them at us at PoliticoastPod or throw them in the Slack. Let's put them in the hashtag random channel. Everything else is pretty busy. Become a patron, patreon.com/politicoast, and give us your predictions. I want to be optimistic, but it's really tough. We do live in our nice little bubble here in BC.
Joining me now is Micah, returning for, what's this, your 6th, 7th time back on the podcast to discuss legal issues?
Who's keeping count at this point?
Well,
great to be back, Scott. Thanks a lot. Okay.
Well, happy to have you here. First off, just how's it going?
It's been, as we were discussing before we started recording, it's been difficult to concentrate on anything else today. I think that there was an attempted siege, or perhaps a successful siege, of the U.S. Capitol. So it's been difficult to concentrate on anything else, but we have some important high-level business to talk about today.
Yeah, and just for the audience clarity, we're recording this a couple days early on January 6th. You'll be hearing this on the 8th, and yeah, it has been quite a day. But that's not what you're on here to talk about. Specifically, we're bringing you back on the pod to discuss a recent case out of the BC Supreme Court, was it?
Yes.
Yes, the BC Supreme Court regarding the pandemic rules and whether a polyamorous dad is in breach of COVID orders living with a new partner and what that says about the broader issues around public health orders, COVID, and the law. Ida, you actually reached out to us about discussing this. What is it about this case that prompted you to want to discuss it?
This case, in my view, serves as a very useful case study to discuss the public health orders that are in place in the province. I suspect that for the majority of Politico's listeners, they'll be concerned with following the rules that are in place and respecting Dr. Bonnie Henry's guidance on how to behave. But there is this fundamental disconnect that I know a lot of my own colleagues have been feeling between what they understand the rules to be, what the rules are on paper, and how they have been interpreted. So this case that you're discussing that I'm going to be talking about, in my view, is a very useful case study in this gap between what people understand and what the interpretations now are from the courts.
Okay, so could you give us kind of a brief overview of what was at stake here and what the actual outcome was?
Yeah, so just to give a bit of a background on the legislative framework here, under the Public Health Act, the chief provincial health officer, who is Dr. Bonnie Henry, can declare a public health emergency, which unlocks a range of emergency powers. And those include the power to make certain orders that can carry penalties. And in November, orders were put in place which addressed several different issues, stating, for example, that you couldn't meet with anyone inside or outside of your residence or vacation accommodation. But if you lived on your own, you could have up to two other people at the private residence, but only if you regularly interacted with these people. And I'm not going to get too far down the rabbit hole of what these orders say, because as I'm going to get into, the interpretation of how these orders actually work was the seminal issue. And the decision is slightly varied from what people might expect it to be based on a reading of the orders themselves. But effectively, the orders that were put in place forbid any gathering of two or more people unless the gathering was otherwise expressly permitted or exempted within the orders. So dealing right. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so that's the rough background on what the province has decided its pandemic framework is going to be when it comes to minimizing contacts to stop the spread. But that also has to be implemented in everyone's messy real lives. And what was that bit of messiness that led these parties into a courtroom? What's the specific background here?
Exactly. So the reason why I established this framework is because where the rubber hits the road so frequently in this pandemic has been in the context of family law and the specific issue of co-parenting, which was the issue in this case, which is stylized as Buckman and Wickman. So what happens when you have parents who have two small children and the children don't live full time in the residence? Are the parents living on their own? What about a parent that has a new partner move in during the term of the order? And these are the issues that were grappled with by Justice Kent, who issued his reasons in the case. And the facts of the case, very briefly, are that mom and dad have two kids. There's a separation. The parties agree to a co-parenting plan dealing with parenting time or custody time. Dad embarks on a polyamorous relationship after the separation. The new partner has another partner, a husband. All of the partners, dad, his new partner, the partner's partner, consent to this multi-party relationship. Dad swears that all the parties have sealed off their bubbles aside from their romantic arrangement. Dad's new partner stays at dad's place when the kids aren't there. And mom is just not a fan of this arrangement, prevents the kids from visiting, citing concerns about COVID. And what the basis for her decision is that it amounts to a breach of the November orders.
And the partner here isn't just, you know, staying occasionally. This is someone who actually had a key to the apartment, was trying to get a parking spot. So, like, a serious relationship.
Absolutely. And those are part of the findings by Justice Kent. In fact, I would say those types of facts informed the ultimate conclusion that he came to. It was the sincerity and the seriousness of the relationship that, in my view, yielded the ultimate result. And that those determinations are made in the decision between paragraphs 38 and 42. It demonstrates that the kids are deemed to be occupants of both mom and dad's place. And importantly, in this context, he determines that the degree of commitment between dad and his new partner, where, as you were saying, Scott, dad's new partner is occupying the place to such a degree that she could be considered to be staying within the orders dictates. It's as if she's staying at a vacation accommodation. So while it's not her primary residence, it can still be considered a vacation accommodation because of the degree of permanence, the attachment to this, to dad's places.
And that vacation rental or vacation accommodation thing seemed a little weird to me when I was skimming through this, but it's basically just the way that the public health orders were structured to allow people to stay at places that weren't their primary residence, but could still be bubbled off.
That's right. There's no real distinction between a primary residence and a vacation residence within the parameters of the rules for the specific purpose of how many people you can have in your bubble, for example.
So it just got labeled vacation accommodation, but doesn't like functionally mean that, or is it exclusively vacations?
That's the way it's been interpreted here because there's no guidance in the orders. So doubling back to my primary point, which was people feel as if they don't know whether they're actually abiding by the rules or not. This is why I wanted to bring this case to your attention, is because it's a perfect example. It's an illustration of people trying to follow the rules, not sure if they're following the rules, and a judge reading through the orders and making a determination that even though this dad's place may not actually be a vacation accommodation within the purview of the public health orders, it can be interpreted that way.
So with the public health orders overall, there's definitely been a bunch of questions people raised. I know at least among my social circle, there was more questions raised about all of these things are talking about families, but single people have been pretty much left off entirely until that was clarified a couple days later with the two regular contacts rule. Why do you think there has been so much confusion here? Is it just simply that doctors aren't lawyers? Is there a process problem? Is there like a conceptual disconnect somewhere?
Obviously, this gap between what the rules probably should be or what they can be and how they are now being interpreted is attributable to the fact that this pandemic is moving at a lightning pace, that those individuals drafting the orders aren't necessarily given a lot of time to have those orders reviewed for these types of gaps where you have, for example, a co-parenting arrangement for a polyamorous relationship, for example. So I'm willing to give a little bit of slack to the drafters in that context, but I also would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that the premier of the province has also had his own difficulties with understanding what the orders exactly say and what they're meant to be. And not just the premier, if you'll recall, the premier was acting on the advice of the Minister of Health, who said that Mr. Horgan could spend Christmas Day at home with his wife and his son and his daughter-in-law. And he had to change his plans once it was pointed out to him that kind of gathering was actually in breach of the public health orders.
I had a bit of a sheepish walk back on that. And it probably lucky for him that happened before Christmas rather than being caught up in everything that's happened post-Christmas with politicians and their holiday plans.
My point is that for listeners who feel as though maybe they've overstepped, maybe they've made a mistake, I don't think anybody necessarily is going to be perfect in trying to ensure that they stay within the bounds of the public health orders that have been passed.
So what's the way to improve this going forward, do you think? I know lawyers like to have paragraphs and clauses on clauses with exceptions and clarifications, but most people probably aren't going through every document the public health officer has ever released on this. Do you have ideas on how we could improve this going forward to actually help the public understand?
The easy answer is to say solicit feedback. This type of issue, this confusion over how many people could be in the bubble, this was not some new issue that just propped up out of nowhere. In fact, as soon as the public health orders were passed in the first place, I know Professor David Gill at the University of Victoria was harping on these obvious gaps, and it was only a matter of time before someone sought clarification. And I suspect this Wickham case won't be the last time someone appears in court seeking clarification. So the easy answer is to say you can always solicit feedback from the legal community. I'm not sure to what extent the public health office is actually doing that. The other thing that they can, of course, do is spend more money on this issue, hire more drafters, have more oversight over this type of an issue. But as I was mentioning earlier, there's no silver bullet. The pandemic is changing on a day-to-day basis, a week-to-week basis. There are orders that need to be created. And because of the personalization of specific circumstances, it's difficult to cover every gap that can be envisioned. So I'm willing to give a little bit of slack to the province in trying to ensure that they have a robust, comprehensive legislative regime. But I do tend to think that there are gaps that can be covered.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Before I let you go, I just want to pivot quickly on to the other aspect of this, which is this is a family law case, which is a matter of law or area of law that I think probably has not only quite a few people interested in it, but continually evolving. Does this decision significantly change or update the understanding of that type of law in BC at all? Is there much significance on that respect?
I don't think so. And I also must admit that I'm not a member of the family law bar. And I see how the family law bar in the province has been at the front lines grappling with the orders probably more than any other specialization within the bar, let's say, like the contracts bar, for example, has been dealing with the pandemic in a different way and not really with the orders that have been passed by the province, for example. But I will say this, COVID has exacerbated many of the challenges that parents traditionally face. Not only do you have these fights over custody time where one parent is in a polyamorous relationship, there are cases about how to make decisions regarding the child caring. If you're on the front lines, let's say there was a case that was passed in Ontario where you had a dad who was on the front lines and child care was predominantly being done by elderly parents. And the court decided in that case that it didn't make them happy, but they had to scale back the type of visitations dad would have with the kids because the primary consideration is always best interest of the child. And when you're dealing with COVID, it adds a completely new context to trying to determine what exactly that is. So in the Ontario case I'm referencing, dad had to meet with the kids outside and didn't have the same amount of time, but all on the understanding, the court said, that this was just a temporary measure, that the hope was vaccinations would come out and everything could go back to normal as quickly as possible.
Right. Okay. And then I guess the only other thing that kind of stood out to me is this is a non-traditional relationship here, and the laws can be a little conservative at times on a lot of these things. Is this the first... I understand that this isn't your area of practice. Do you know if this is the first time polyamory is actually being recognized in the law as a kind of significant factor in these sorts of things? Or
no, this I can tell you from law school, that polyamory and polygamy have been separate for the better part of 10 years, better part of a decade now. And that there was a case recently, I seem to recall, in the Maritimes, where you had a polyamorous trifecta who were all declared parents of one child. So this isn't the first time that polyamory has come up, but it did introduce a very interesting wrinkle to this fact pattern.
Okay. Before I let you go, is there any points we didn't hit on that you briefly want to mention?
Nope. I think that's great.
Okay. Micah, thanks for joining me tonight. People are interested in, I guess, following you on social media. Where can they find you?
They can find me on Twitter, at Micah Goldberg.
Okay. Micah, thanks for once again coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on again, Scott.
Let's quickly round out the show with a few quick takes. So the thing that I was actually planning on talking about before everything happened was the nationwide scandal / mass resignation and firings that have happened in governments and capitals across the country from politicians deciding that maybe a pandemic is in fact the perfect time
it's
to travel.
It's some shocking hypocrisy and just bad political judgment from all kinds of people who you would think would know better, like chiefs of staff, cabinet ministers, people in charge of, I think it was the Alberta Municipal Affairs Minister, Tracy Allard, I've heard was in charge of the vaccine rollout and went to, I think she was in Vegas or Hawaii. Like,
she went,
politicians across all parties, Nikki Ashton, the NDP, lots of people in the United Conservative Party in Alberta, and a couple, not backbench, but like parliamentary secretary level federal liberals, Victoria Councillor Sharma K. Dubo. Is that how you pronounce his name? I don't actually know.
I am not sure.
He's fairly prominent and popular. One of the more left-wing councillors there. He went back to visit his family. Like, lots has been said on this. Very few people are defending these moves, although a number of people are trying to defend Nikki Ashton, which is just partisan grossness. Like, she should have known better. There's a lot of discussion that I liked on this on episodes 906 and 906 and a half of The Strategists, and they look at it particularly from their experience in communications and working as the chief of staff. And like, clearly people like Jason Kenney, the premier, should have or undoubtedly did know about people taking vacations. So go check out those episodes. We'll throw the link to that podcast in the show notes. I feel like everything's been said. It's bad.
Yeah, so I could talk about a bunch of this stuff, but I think the kind of key thing that I took away from this is just like, what a shocking lack of leadership on the part of the people who are supposed to be leading the country. I had it drilled into me that the first rule of leadership is lead by example, and that you need to model the behavior you expect from others. And it just seems either nobody at various levels in government ever learned that, or they learned that and disregarded it. And either way, that's a pretty shocking failure. And politicians aren't just there to do what the citizens want or enact an agenda. They're also important leaders, and they actually need to act like leaders, and they
and it comes
have
at
not
such
done
a
that.
Frustratingly key juncture, right? BC just extended its restrictions on social gatherings until February 5th, another month of this. And to make these restrictions work, we need social cohesion. We need people to buy in. We need the level of we're all in this together that we had in March and April, but we can't have that when people see political leaders flaunting the rules, because then they realize there are different rules for the elites and for the plebs. We all need to be in this together. So credit to the political leaders who are taking this seriously, like even Doug Ford firing his finance minister pretty quickly.
He was actually the first mover on that. The first person to lose their job over this was the finance minister fired by Doug Ford.
So we'll keep an eye on this story. It might keep going, or it might fizzle out by next week. as we all focus on the U.S.?
I think that it will fizzle out in the respect that we probably are not going to get another big set of revelations about high-profile politicians traveling when they shouldn't be. But I think the long-term harm and impact of this will not be going away anytime soon for the reasons you just articulated.
Speaking of long-term impacts, Statistics Canada came out in mid-December, actually, with a story I think we both missed until in the last week, which is that Canadian population growth hit the lowest on record during third quarter of 2020, as Canada grew by only 2,700 people in Q3, which is the lowest growth since 1946.
You didn't forget to say 2,000 after that, did you?
767 people. We actually decreased the number of permanent residents as people went back to whatever country they hold citizenship in. It sounds like BC actually decreased by 1,861 people in that third quarter. We were the province with the largest drop in population. Now, it's not really surprising that Canada wasn't bringing in new people when we have effectively closed the borders, vacationing politicians exempted. It still stands, though, in contrast to the federal Liberals' new targets of 401,000 new immigrants this year and 421,000 in 2023.
Yeah. I also kind of wonder if there's going to be a small baby boom that's going to start to show up in the statistics in the next couple months. So that might help reverse this a bit. But yeah, it's concerning. Modern countries' kind of prosperity and just ability to shape the world and get stuff done is in large part contingent on its population, and arguably much more so than the natural resources underneath it. And it's hard to be a thriving country that isn't growing and is just stagnant or shrinking. So there are obviously factors that have contributed to this that are outside anyone's control, but it is concerning that it has shrunk so low and is going to be concerning if that can't manage to get reversed, or and doesn't not only just get reversed but arguably more than compensated for going forward. Because at the start of the show we talked about the need to chart a more independent path from the U.S., but practically speaking, that can't work when we're a tenth their size. And if we want to be more independent, we also need to just have more Canadians to facilitate that. But BC may be losing people. The BC political parties are gaining some finances. As it was announced this week, what the public subsidy distribution was going to be for the various political parties as a result of the 2020 election votes.
It turns out an advantage of having an election in 2020 meant the calculations get to be redone. So rather than the $1.75 that all the parties were scheduled to get in 2021 for their 2017 votes, it's now recalculated, and Elections BC has announced what that is. The big winners are the BC NDP, quite obviously. They'll be getting almost 1.6 million, which is up 180,000 over their previous result. The BC Conservatives actually met one of the thresholds, so they'll be getting $63,000. And the Rural BC Party also met one of the thresholds, so they'll get $1,300. The thresholds are that you either need 2% of the votes province-wide, or 5% of the votes cast in one district, at least one district.
Which is where the Rural BC Party managed to succeed. They only ran like one or two candidates, I think, but actually in the north they got a decent showing in, yeah, I think it was Stikine. And so yeah, they get a little money for that. It's easy to talk about how the NDP is the big winner, because they get the largest single check, but in terms of like marginal value for the BC any of these parties, 62,000 is for the BC Conservatives.
They can hire someone.
Not nothing, particularly. Yeah, particularly because they don't have a well-functioning fundraising apparatus that can bring in a lot of money. So this is probably going to actually represent one of the largest shares of their total revenue of any of the parties listed here.
But how are the Liberals and Greens doing off of this?
So the Liberals lost $480,000 from what they were getting paid before, and they're down to $1.11 million. That's just a result of getting fewer votes, which is not great, both because, well, they lost a bunch of seats, and their fundraising apparatus wasn't working all that well pre-election. We talked quite a bit every time the fundraising results came out for the last couple of years. The BC Liberals were struggling a bit, and this will not help them. The Greens are also down a bit, $84,000 in this case. They've been a growing party, so this might get a little more offset compared to where they were a couple of years ago, just from being more established and professionalizing their operations, including fundraising. But nevertheless, it's still a loss for them that is not insignificant that they will be feeling.
Yeah, it definitely makes things a lot harder for the BC Liberals, whose fundraising had not been as strong under the new rules, and particularly with the interim leader, it'll be a struggle. So extra bonus advantage for the governing party.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.